Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Scott W. Berg. He has a new book out. It's called 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vic. It's a pleasure to be here.
Scott, over the last couple of years, we've had a lot of books coming out about the Civil War, and we're 150 years away from that horrific war. And now all these books are coming out, and your book is a Civil War book, but it's not really a Civil War book. But then it is a Civil War book because the Civil War kind of obscured this event that occurred right in the middle of the Civil War.
Sure. It's the Dakota War of 1862. It happened in Minnesota and the Dakota Territories, and involved in an uprising of several hundred Dakota Indians from Minnesota, who sort of a splinter group of the much larger tribe who attacked both sort of federal and state forces, but also settlers. And several hundred settlers were killed, as many, depending on what source you sort of believe, between 400 and 600 settlers were killed. And this was 6 weeks of incredibly intense action on the frontier along the Minnesota River in what then was considered the northwestern frontier, and ended with the sort of expulsion of the Dakota Indians from the state, the larger group of many thousands of Dakota Indians, and the execution of 38 Dakota Indians on a single scaffold the day after Christmas in 1862. An execution that would have been much larger, would have been 303 Dakota, until Abraham Lincoln personally signed the order to lift, at least temporarily, the sentences of a full 265 of those Indians. So it was a very intense sort of event. The kind of event, I might add, that would have been received a much more prominent place in textbooks along events, alongside events like Little Bighorn and Wounded Knee, had it not occurred under cover of the larger conflict of the Civil War.
Well, people are thinking about the Civil War. One of the biggest movies in the country is about Abe Lincoln and the Civil War right now. And poor Abe Lincoln, here he was in 1862. Things were going very badly for the Union. They were losing a lot of battles, and things just weren't going well at all. And then suddenly, he's got this annoying distraction in Minnesota.
Yes, in fact, it wasn't, that's well said, and it wasn't just that 1862 was a bad period for Lincoln in the war, and I'm not the first person certainly to notice this, but 1862 wasn't just a bad period, it was the lowest period of the war, especially mid-1862. And by extension, if it was the worst period of the war for the Union, now, of course, this is for the Confederacy, they viewed it differently, but for the Union, if this is the worst period of war, in many ways it was the low point of the country since its creation, in the sense that the very real possibility of the breakup of the United States was, you know, people were looking at that as a fairly imminent possibility. Robert E. Lee was advancing on Washington, D.C., which felt rather underprotected or even unprotected at that time. And the possibility that the Confederacy might sort of occupy D.C. and Lee might be fully successful, and that eventually they would have to sit down and decide what the shape of the new Union and the Confederacy, the two different nations, was going to look like. So it was a very low point. And yes, and then this does come up. This does arrive by telegraph at the War Department next to the White House, and the first telegraphs are in a way almost not incomprehensible, but sort of inconceivable. Hundreds of settlers dead, and of course the exaggeration, though, and the entire regions depopulated, entire states in danger of emptying, and a unified Indian front across the West, conducting attacks and ready to sort of mount this offensive Very real fear for people in the East that this is going to happen. Part of the reason that was a real fear, of course, is because many of them had no real picture of how disparate and sort of attached to their own agendas many of the Indian tribes were. The possibility of dozens of Indian tribes teaming up and sort of mounting a unified attack wasn't a very real one, but it didn't mean it wasn't a possibility that was taken very seriously back east and back at the White House.
And the telegrams, some of them tended to exaggerate.
Yes, very much so. And it depended on who was writing them, of course. But these were governors and colonels stationed at federal forts along the Indian frontier. And one gets a sense reading this that they were very well aware of the context of their messages, meaning that Lincoln's attention and by extension the attention of his administration was directed, of course, at the Civil War. And so the way to get attention was to be loud, and the way to get attention was to make the situation as dramatic and the crisis as large as it could be. It didn't mean that it wasn't a dramatic situation and a large crisis. It was. But yes, there was all kinds of reports, as I said, of, dozens of tribes combining and tens of thousands of mounted Indian warriors moving back eastward. This simply wasn't the truth. The truth was amazing enough, is that this sort of long collision of Indian and white along the American frontier, at least at this one place in Minnesota and the Dakota Territory, was coming to a head.
Scott W. Berg joins us. His book is 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. This is history. I don't detect any particular bias on your part as a writer, but as we read it, it's very difficult not to sympathize with the situation that these Indians were in that really lit the flames and started this rampage and the violence. They were in a really bad situation, weren't they? Let's give our listeners some sense of what instigated this rebellion.
Sure, and that was a highly contentious and debated subject in the immediate aftermath, and even sort of for many, many decades after this event. So it wasn't a settled subject. Many of the settlers and government officials on the frontier felt there was no sort of real cause for this, which leaves you sort of in an odd position, in an uncomfortable position, because, well, if there was no proximate cause, then essentially what you're saying is there's sort of an inbred natural tendency simply to violence among the Dakota Indians. And the more you read about this, and this is, scholarship over the last 50 years certainly does not agree with that, and the more you read about it, the more you understand. No, this is a pull back the lens, let's say, in a perspective of hundreds of years, and you look at the Dakota and their rivals, the Ojibwe and the Sac and Fox, occupying millions and millions of acres of land up by the Great Lakes and up in toward the Northwest, and living lives that were essentially, if not the same year to year, certainly patterns had formed that were many, many hundreds of years old. And then, of course, here come these new folks. And one of the most interesting parts of this story is that for hundreds of years, there was a sort of interconnectedness between white and Indian, that the fur traders and the settlers and the missionaries, who did not outnumber the Dakota at all, intermarry. They have trade relationships. They have friendships. Many of them were guarded, sure, friendships. But there's sort of a long history of a sort of interconnectedness there. And then here comes this population pressure after the, in the early parts of the 19th century. Here comes this desire for statehood, here comes this desire for the natural resources, for the land, for farming, for political influence in the terms of forming states. And suddenly the relationship changes. And treaty, the pressure to sign treaties when maybe, you know, there's 25 significant Dakota leaders and six of them are signing on to a treaty or invited to a, and then the news given to the rest of the Dakota Indians as well, some of your leaders signed a treaty, so here, you know, we're going, this land is now ours. And by hundreds of thousands of acres, the Dakota land shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. Every single, four or five different treaties over the course of 30 or 40 years, all disputed treaties, hardly unanimous among the Dakota people. Some Dakota people really only understood the treaties for the first time when they were told to leave their land, it was sacred land to them that their ancestors may have lived on for years and years and years. So there's that. There's also sort of the general disregard for Dakota culture among many of the newly arrived whites who felt this is now our land and these are our customs and your customs don't fit with our customs. There's also, as I said, economic considerations that this was fertile, valuable land. But really what I say in the book is that these are parallel universes that in so many ways, lifestyle, attitude toward the land, attitude toward authority, attitude toward who had the right to make decisions for you, the power structure, all those things are in a way so incompatible that it leads to eventually a sense that the two worlds can't coexist. And it's a small group of Dakota warriors who reaches this conclusion, but a young, very frustrated, angry group of Dakota warriors who doesn't see where the future for their ages-old way of life is, and this is the result. There are some smaller immediate causes, smaller conflicts, murders on the frontier in which a small group of four Dakota Indians ends up murdering a family of settlers seems to be the spark, but it's been building and building for hundreds of years. And so you pull back the lens to that distance and you start to get a certain case, a certain sense of the situation. You pull in the lens and you see people who are just confused on both sides, who don't know what's happening, and so the sense of chaos at close range is really palpable in this.
Let them eat grass.
Yes, absolutely. Those are the words of the trader, Andrew Myrick, and the Dakota Indians had a very interesting and unfortunate relationship with the traders, who had been among them, but these were the traders who provided goods and foods and all kinds of sort of items for the Dakota Indians and provide them these goods on credit. You would receive in exchange for the treaty, for signing the treaty, Dakotas would receive annuity payments in gold. And then they would use those annuity payments to pay for goods traders. And if they, traders, it was largely unregulated, the traders could sort of ask what they wanted. And if a Dakota did not have enough to pay for it, they would simply extend credit until the next year's annuity payments. This became a cycle of debt that eventually in 1862 reaches a head for many reasons. And many Dakotas say, you know, you have to extend us more credit. You have to give us these goods. We need something to eat. And the trader Andrew Myrick's response to that in 1862, he's unsure because of the Civil War and other factors. He's unsure if those annuity payments are ever coming again. And so he tells them that if they don't. If they can eat grass, they can eat grass or their own dung. And those words exchanged just a few weeks before the uprising, they don't necessarily cause the uprising. The causes come from a much wider, as I said, view. But certainly those words become a sort of slogan among the Dakota as these warriors sort of launch this uprising.
And Little Crow was the chief who took the rap, who supposedly led this rebellion.
Right. And for many years after the Dakota War, during the Dakota War and for many years after. Many people called it Little Crow's War. He was the Dakota leader who sort of stood up at the beginning. He was asked to stand up by these Dakota warriors and sort of act as their spokesman and sort of de facto leader. What we've learned in the last 100 years is a couple different things. Is one, that no one Dakota led this group of people. There were actually what they call soldiers' lodges, or sort of private groups of warriors who traditionally had been sort of organized to take charge of, say, a hunting season, hunting expeditions, or even raids against, the Ojibwe to the north, the Ojibwe Indians to the north. These sort of transform rapidly in 1861 and 1862 to sort of war councils led sort of independent of the structure of elders, say, of tribal elders. Little Crow, by the time this war starts, he's a fascinating character. He's so unlike, at least in the record left to history, he's so unlike, say, Sitting Bull or Crazy Horse, in that those two warriors are famous for sort of what we don't know about them, they're famous for their freedom, their independence, the purity of sort of their resistance, that we will draw this line, and any crossing of this line, we will resist, resist, resist. Little Crow is very different. He grew up among white fur traders. He had spent plenty of time in the growing white city of St. Paul. Little Crow, by the time of these events, has been to Washington, D.C. twice on two separate train trips. Trips that he went on, at least one of the trips he went on with several white politicians from Minnesota. He's visited with presidents. He's visited with secretaries of state. He's visited the photography studios in Washington. He's seen all of the industrial might along the way, from the long train trip from Chicago, essentially, but from Minnesota to Washington, D.C. He's probably seen more of America and more different parts of America than any other Dakota Indian, and he's a very complex character. He sort of agrees to lend his voice and his influence to this uprising as a way to sort of reclaim his position in the tribe. And he also operates out of a sense of, I guess, what we'd call fatalism. He has seen what the military and the economic might of the East will eventually visit upon Minnesota, is visiting upon Minnesota at this time. And sort of sense of fatalism that if we launch this war now, we're not likely to win it, but when else are we going to make our stand? And so he's, in that sense, a much more complex character. He sort of sees many sides of things. He's lived many sides of sort of this entire experience. And ultimately, the story is his personal tragedy, as well as the Dakota people's tragedy.
Scott W. Berg joins us. His book is 38 Nooses. Lots of tragedy, all right, lots of heartbreak, and probably the most tragic story in here is about a warrior named Chaska who did something good and ended up going to the gallows.
Yes, Chaska, and his story is intertwined with that of a white captive named Sarah Wakefield, who, after the war is over, she leaves writes a captivity narrative, one of the many, many captivity narratives that was written. Some people argue that the Indian captivity narrative is America's only truly indigenous literary form, in fact, because you see them for hundreds of years, almost always written by women, though not in every case. And she leaves a narrative behind called 6 Weeks in the Sioux Teepees. Is very different than most captivity narratives, many of which are framed as in terms of a sort of gauzy religiosity, meaning this is a test visited upon me by God, and my survival of this test is related to the sort of my relationship to God. Sarah Wakefield was in an unhappy marriage to a doctor to the Indians, to what they called an agency doctor, John Wakefield. She was in an unhappy marriage on the frontier. She's taken captive. She was very familiar with many of what the so-called friendly Dakota Indians, some of them Christianized Dakota Indians, some not, on the frontier. And in the course of at the very beginning of this, when she's taken captive, her life is in great danger, and one of those Dakota Indians that she already knew saves her life. His name is Chaska. And over the next 6 weeks, he, Chaska, and Chaska's mother take very extraordinary steps in these large, chaotic Dakota camps full of thousands of Dakotas, not all of whom agreed with the aims of the war or who felt they, you know, they had a common leader. They take extraordinary steps to keep Sarah and her two young children to keep them safe during this. And at the end, Chaska, despite assurances to the contrary, is arrested, and eventually he's convicted. Chaska ends up stepping forward at one moment, when the name Chaska is called, utterly unaware of why that name is even being called. And from there, it's sort of a set of really absurd sort of either misunderstandings or some would maintain intentional misunderstandings, results in Chaska stepping onto that gallows on the day after Christmas 1862 and being hung, though his name was not on the list of 39 or 38 that Lincoln deemed culpable, and he ends up hanged for crimes at least that Lincoln and his the folks reviewing the trials maintained he didn't commit. Many Dakota Indians would say none of the 38 hanged. Many Dakota Indians and others would say that many of the 38 or all the 38 hanged did not deserve to be hanged. But Chaska is certainly a case of someone who should not have even been on the scaffold. And one of the most heart-wrenching scenes in the research is when Sarah Wakefield, who is many towns away by that point, reads in a newspaper that Chaska has in fact been hanged, and she fully blames herself for his being hanged. And it's a very poignant scene, yes.
Scott W. Berg has joined us on the program today. His book is 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. I see we're running out of time here. One of the great ironies in this entire story to me is that Abe Lincoln, at the same time he's trying to decide which of the people on this list of 300-some names should be granted stays of execution, he's also planning on releasing the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, freeing the many enslaved residents of the rebellious states of the Confederacy. And yet here are these natives of the land in Minnesota who are not included in this proclamation, are they?
No, and it's an interesting, it is ironic, and it's in some ways it's very ironic, and in other ways it's less ironic than it might seem. At the same time Lincoln is considering and planning for the Emancipation Proclamation, he's also very very carefully and at some length thinking about not only emancipation, but colonization. In other words, once African Americans are freed, where are we going to send them? Mm. And the most common sort of possibilities for that were places like Panama or near Panama and islands. Really, a lot of different possibilities are floated for this. But one of the sometimes floated possibilities is, well, we've got a lot of land out west, and assuming this, you know, war goes successfully, we're going to be able to sort of, you know, that land's going to be free to use. And so just as many of the Cherokee and other southeastern tribes were, quote-unquote, given the Oklahoma Territory, making it an Indian territory, so too is the discussion to create a kind of, the only word that fits is reservation for freed slaves. And so in some ways, there's an interesting sort of connection. It's not that in the one hand of emancipation, racial attitudes were entirely enlightened, and in the other hand, with Native Americans, racial attitudes were, you know, retrograde. Rather, it's simply that that given the Civil War, given its causes, given its sectional nature, that the dispensation of slaves was just had a whole different set of conditions. And it's well known that emancipation is a large part of the Emancipation Proclamation is it was considered as a war measure, as a part of the overall war effort against the South. The situation with Native Americans is very different. It didn't seem to many people in the East to do them any good in terms of the war effort. And so there's two totally different considerations. So it's sort of a surface irony that the further and further and further you dig, you realize that, well, there's a lot of sort of commonalities to it, to, rather the external circumstances of the two different relationships between races is different. It's completely fascinating, and it's also something that's impossible to sort of fully understand in your mind, because each time you look at it from one angle, you see this, and each time you look at it from another angle, you see that. And I guess the only thing that the book would say to that sort of concretely is that many times we think of the Civil War era, and the Civil War especially, because of the Emancipation, so we think of race as sort of a two-way street. There's white and black, right? Black and white. But really, I always think of it, and the study of a story like this teaches, you know, it pull back the lens a little bit. The story of race in America is extremely complex, of course, but it's certainly an equilateral triangle in terms of white African American, but also Native American. There is no sense that the concerns of Native American and the collision of white and Native American on the frontier was not a part of the national fabric during the Civil War era. It absolutely was. Yes, when battles like Antietam and Gettysburg are happening, there's sort of a certain volume to that. It sort of blots out everything else. But just because that blots out everything else doesn't mean that these concerns weren't still very much part of the national fabric. And so in that way, there's sort of a connection there as well.
Well, Scott, we really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been Scott W. Berg. His book is 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. One of my favorite books from the past year was written by Joe Queenan. It's a book about his love affair with books. It's called One for the Books. Next week, Joel Queenan will join us on the program and talk to us about his passion for books and only certain kinds of books, real books. Joe is not an e-book reader. Joe is very particular about the books that he reads, and he doesn't care what you think of his opinions, but he's certainly happy to express them. Joe Queenan returns to the Book Nook next week, right here on WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.